Step inside, ladies and gentlemen. See the amazing U.S. equity markets. They go to all-time highs regardless of what's happening in the world at any given point. Armageddon, Black Plague, we don't care. All-time highs. That's right, folks. This is what happens when you don't have a market. By the way, this is the QTR podcast. All hell is breaking loose, and I got George Gammon here today with me to help figure everything out. But before we do that, first and foremost, I want to shout out the people that make this podcast possible. Those are my patrons. Patrons are people just like you, the listener. I know you don't think I'm talking about you specifically, but yes, you, person that's listening to this right now. Patrons are people just like you that listen to the podcast and have decided to donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of my patrons, then I'm going to give you the rules for the podcast, then we're going to get going with my man, Mr. George Gammon. First and foremost, I want to shout out my friends over at the Trader's Path. My buddy Pete over at the Trader's Path wanted to start a day trading service that was different from all the nonsense and bullshit that's out there, the guys that just take your money. They don't care about you. They front run your trades. Pete was involved with those services. He hated them, so he said, I'm starting the Trader's Path on my own. What do you get with the Trader's Path aside from a guy running it that's not a complete and total fuckhead? The guys over at the Trader's Path, they trade in red markets. They trade in green markets. They trade options. They trade equities. They don't mess with fraud. They don't mess with low float garbage. They're not going to front run you. They trade all types of instruments on all types of days. They're going to give you daily watch lists. You're going to get a community to be a part of. So you're going to get a look at the trades that these guys are examining on a daily basis. You're going to get a live stream that happens all day, every day, so you can follow along and trade together as a community. You're going to get investor education and investor advocacy. And also, Pete, right now, running a special. If you're a QTR podcast listener, and the link is in my podcast description, he's running a special not only for regular accounts, but also for those who are business people that don't trade full-time. So if you only trade on the side as a hobby, he's not going to ask you to come in and pay a full admission if you're just using the service on a part-time basis. Instead, he created a businessman special that he's offering right now, I think for $100 off. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, Pete, but I've just offered your service for $100 off, so you better be giving that to people now. For people that want to sign up for his new service, which is geared specifically towards people that can't trade full-time but still want to get the benefits of the service. I know Pete. He's an honest guy. He's an ardent supporter of the podcast. I love having him as a patron. Please check out the Trader's Path. Also, two other great tools if you are a day trader. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room have been tracking big money coming into the options market for almost a decade. Wall Street Jesus and Sang Lucci, these guys coined the term sweeps. When you hear people say, oh, there's call sweepers coming in, this guy created the fucking dictionary, okay, for options traders 10 years ago. That's how much of OGs these guys are. They have been doing it for a long time, and they are offering a special. If you're a QTR podcast listener and you want access to the Sang Lucci Steam Room, which is their daily chat that follows all the money coming into the options market, which can be very good in helping telegraph moves in the equity markets, you can check out their link in my podcast description, or just find Lucci on the web out there. He's on Twitter. His email's out there. Email Sang Lucci directly. Tell that motherfucker Chris Irons from the QTR podcast sent you, and you want half off whatever the hell he's doing, and he'll hook you up because Lucci is my homeboy. I trust him. Another guy that's not a complete and total fuckhead running a business. Great people to help support. If you're not interested in the Steam Room or options trading, Lucci also offers the 3LT playbook, which is his playbook for how he became a seven-figure trader, and he offers the Sang Lucci Master Course, which is an investor education course, also available in the podcast description. Best part about those two guys and my forthcoming patron, Rumor Hound, they're good people that I trust. When is Rumor Hound gonna be useful in your toolbox? Well, how about this? Rumor Hound is a service that has a proprietary artificial intelligence algorithm that helps determine whether merger and acquisition rumors in the news are worth following or perhaps worth ignoring. When can that be useful, Chris? How about just 5 fucking seconds ago when it hit the wire that Cisco may be looking to make a bid for FireEye? So if you're a Rumor Hound user, a Rumor Hound subscriber, Rumorhound is going to take that information. It's going to take the viability of the transaction, the credibility of the sources, and a whole bunch of other proprietary variables, put it into the algorithm that it has, which is proprietary, and spit out to you what it thinks the probability of the transaction consummating is. As you know, big money can be made and lost if you get a jump on whether or not merger and acquisition rumors are true or false. And Rumorhound is a very unique piece of software that allows you to do that. So when is it useful? How about today? These examples pop up every single day. Find my friends at rumorhound.ai. The link is in the podcast description. Give them a shout. Tell them the QTR podcast sent you. And tell them you're not settling for anything less than a 2-digit discount, at least, for being a QTR podcast listener. I don't have time to remember what all the specials are that everybody offers, but Rumorhound, great service, great people, great software. Same with Lucci and the Trader's Path. I got no problem shouting these people out. No ethical qualms about it at all, because I know they're not douchebags. Speaking of people that are not douchebags, I want to shout out some more of my patrons, then we're going to get started. My newest patrons, how about the people that have been supporting me for a while also too? My friends at Corvus Gold, Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer, subscribe to his shit, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, my homeboy Crichton Titus, Ken and J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson, thank you, and Matt Merle. And finally, getting to the end here, I swear to God, folks, some of my newest patrons, who are the people that have been supporting me recently, Jeffrey Plyman, Danny Hughes, Dave, and Michael Cancellieri. That's what most of my patrons do, they Cancellieri. See what I did there? Lawrence Lepard, David Warden, Dylan and Rob Sittig, Marco Vitti, I still see you, brother, appreciate your emails, too, that I get often from you and your shouts on my YouTube channel. David Hansen, Giancarlo, De Lali, Bob Tankle, and some people that have been with me for a while like John Cooper, Chris Bunting, Creepy Old Pedo Guy, Travis Davis, Dave Osten, Jason Bernstein, and how about Ethan Watkins? What's up, brother? I still see you. Two rules for the podcast. Take two drinks to the face, folks. This is an alcohol-enhanced podcast. What does that mean? It means the drunker you are, the better the podcast gets. It's like checking me out at a bar somewhere. You see me when you walk in the door and you're sober, there's really not much going on. After 13 Coors Lights and 6 shots of Fireball, all of a sudden you're talking to fucking Brad Pitt. It's amazing how those things work out. Last but not least, I am not a financial advisor. Neither is my guest. None of this is financial advice. We have a little saying here on the podcast. It's called, do your research elsewhere. What does it mean? I don't want to hear about your trading successes, and I don't want to hear about your trading failures. Keep your shit to yourself. Talk to your therapist, somebody that you pay to care, because I don't. Okay, on the line with me today, one of my new favorite friends in the financial industry and one of about 4 people that has a brain and keeps me sane from just the overall lunacy that's going on in the stock market right now, if you even want to call it a market. We just call it the stock clap. You know, remember like Bingo was his name-o? We just don't say the letter, because it's really not a market. My friend George Gammon has a YouTube channel here called George Gammon, imagine that, that has become a resounding success, jumping from something like 15,000 subscribers to like 55,000 subscribers in the course of like 2 months since I've been watching it. He hosts something called the Rebel Capitalist Show. He concisely and clearly explains with a whiteboard and without any profanity how the Austrian School of Economics works and why everything is fucked. I have been on George's program a couple of times, and I am super stoked to finally be interviewing you, Mr. George Gammon. What's going on, brother?
Not much, buddy. Thanks a lot for having me on the show. I'm a huge fan. I've listened for a long time, and I'm just super, super stoked to be here.
Yeah, how the hell did we find each other anyway?
I think I reached out to you on Twitter because I've listened to so many of your interviews. And I thought, oh man, that would be great to get Chris on and interview him. And so I reached out, DM'd you, and I think you responded in like 30 seconds. I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Like, you must have caught me like sitting on the toilet or something when I had my phone like right in front of me, because I have like dozens of unanswered DMs and people like start cursing at me and stuff because I can't get to answering them all. So that's cool that it worked out.
Right, for sure.
So First off, congratulations on the success of your YouTube channel, which is awesome, and I encourage everybody to subscribe it. I will put a link to it in the podcast description here. Why don't you just tell my listeners and me, because I don't really know the story, a little bit on how you got started and what kind of inspired you to make your YouTube channel and what the main idea is and what you do.
Sure. I retired in 2012 as an entrepreneur, and I knew absolutely nothing about macro, knew nothing about investing. I managed to save a little bit more than I spent, so I wanted to learn that for myself. I got into real estate investing in 2012 because I thought it was cheap. And it was really after looking at a chart of the Japanese crash in, call it 90, 91, and then reading a lot of Jim Rogers books. And then I was studying Thomas Sowell at the time, Milton Friedman, guys like that. So that's kind of how I went down the rabbit hole initially. And I just kept with real estate because it's something I knew well. I've done it overseas. I'm currently in Medellin, Colombia, doing a lot of real estate projects. But I still do have projects back in the States. And from there in, the beginning of last year, so the beginning of 2019, I did a show here in Medellin, a reality TV show, which was like a house flipping deal. And it was my idea. I went to the station. I pitched it. They said, yeah, let's do it as long as you produce the show. I said, I have no idea how to produce a TV show, but I'll make it happen. So we did that. We did a season, 13 episodes, and it was a lot of fun. It was really popular, but I really didn't like dealing with the channel that much. So I thought, wow, I've got a bunch of these great editors and camera people. Let's just do a YouTube channel. So I started a YouTube channel for that brand, the TV show. It was Vida and Remodelacion. And I started the George Gammon channel, and I didn't think anyone would want to watch anything to do with macro. So the initial videos were mostly about real estate investing, although what I really like talking about is macro. And so about a month or two into the channel, I said, let's do at least a couple videos here. And I think I did one on Ray Dalio and another on the repo market. And sure enough, those were extremely popular. So back in, call it November of last year, I had like 200 subscribers and the channel was like getting like 20 or 30 views a day. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. I really enjoy this. And then I did a few of those macro videos and they just took off. And then everyone seemed to like the whiteboard videos, so I did more of those. And that was five months ago, something like that. Now there's 57,000 subscribers and the channel gets over 1.5 million views per month.
Holy shit. Hey, that is, and as somebody that is, you know, currently hosting my own YouTube channel and my own podcast, you know, I've gotten some good traction, but that is exponential. That is just absolutely outstanding traction to go from where you were in November of last year to where you are now. So, you know, I've watched a number of your videos after we did our first interview. Admittedly, I hadn't seen any prior to us doing our interview, but I watched a couple after we did our interview, and I understand why people are drawn to your channel because, you know, you lay things out very simply. You know, the Austrian school and our perspective on central banks and capital markets, the way that you and I look at it and most of my listeners, is very simple, you know. Yeah. And it's something that people can understand without a financial background. And I think that is kind of the door that you have helped open for people with your whiteboard videos, explaining to people exactly what all this jargon and nonsense and terminology means, because we both know that's what's being used to cloak the rigging of the market here, right?
For sure. And there's so many people out there that just the average Joe that thinks they're just not intelligent enough to understand quantitative easing, right, or the repo market or something like that. And it has nothing to do with that. They're just as intelligent as these people at the Fed or on Wall Street. It's just they don't understand the lingo. It's just a totally different language. So all I try to do at that whiteboard is take things that seem to be very complex and esoteric and just put it into normal speak, and then just do it with a whiteboard video so that you can see kind of how it flows and the plumbing. And I think there was just a huge need for that. But I think it's really because average people out there know instinctively that there's something wrong.
Right.
That all this money printing, the Fed's balance sheet goes to $4.5 trillion. They're injecting whoever knows how much a night into the repo market. You've got Deutsche Bank. You've got Hong Kong. You've got social unrest all over the world. You've got inflation that the government says is at 2%. Meanwhile, the average person's health care is going up, you know, hockey stick. The food that they buy is going just through the roof. And they're saying, well, what is this? What's going on here? And they can't really connect the dots just because they don't speak that language. But when they are, when I'm able to hopefully show them how things work in a way that they can easily understand, then it's like, oh, the light bulb goes on. Everything that I've been feeling is wrong.
Right.
And I think that's really why the channel was popular. And I think it goes back to common sense. And I was on Twitter this morning talking to a guy, and I was saying, you know, it's not really about the Keynesian school of economics or the Austrian school of economics. It's just about the common sense school of economics. But to your earlier point, I think the Austrians, when you just look at it from that standpoint, have a lot more common sense on their side than the Keynesians do.
And I always compare Keynesian economics, and especially the wild offshoot of Keynesian economics that we're on now, to the idea of building a house from the ground up, right? You build this foundation and a first floor and a second floor and a roof, and you build them all out of generally basic financial principles, supply and demand, you know, savings to create prosperity. So you have money for capital investment, recessions being corrections that are necessary to correct malinvestment, all those basic tenets and principles. And then here we are slowly over the last 40 years have tacked addition after addition after addition onto this little house that we once had, and until it looks like one of those houses you see in the fairy tales where the bottom of the house is really, really small now and the additions coming out of the house, you know, go up to the clouds, right? And they're just going out in every which way and every which direction, and the house just looks like at any time it could fall over. And that is what we have done to the economy in terms of Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid. And just to go back to something you just said about people knowing something's wrong, right, without really being able to put their finger on it. And I mentioned on a prior podcast, and would love to say again here, that with what's been going on in current events right now, let's just look at today. I put out a funny tweet today saying, here's what's driving the bull market, right? The U.S. government comes out today and says that it believes deaths in China, that data can't be relied upon. They're going to file racketeering charges against Huawei, which we know is a point of contention, certainly was in the trade negotiations. We have this giant unknown out there in the coronavirus, which doesn't look like it's going away. Not only that, but it doesn't look like we have much of a handle as to what the hell is going on. Yet the market has shook off every bad news headline today. Like today when Eamon Javers, or the gentleman from Fox Business, reported that the government doesn't have confidence in these China death numbers anymore. The market, you know, spoos dropped 10 handles and then they were bid back up 25 handles, blew past where they were before the news came out, and are now pushing even higher all-time highs now. How long is it going to be, George, before we continue to see real-world risk events being incongruent with what the market is doing before more people start to wake up? And what do you think the consequences of that could be?
That's a fantastic question. I think really what it boils down to is we've been in this mode of good news is good news, and bad news is good news, and horrible news is even better news.
Right.
just because of the Fed's printing, and we have this Pavlovian type of response, or at least the market does, whenever they see the Fed's balance sheet expanding, or now they're like front running it. They think, okay, well, that's definitely going to make the market go up. And if you would have bet that way over the last 12 years, obviously you'd be right. At some point in time, the market says we're not playing that game anymore. Regardless how much money you print,
right,
we're still going down. And to be clear, the market can go up forever, but you can still lose money, because the market can go up in nominal terms, but it might go down in real terms. And the example I always use to illustrate that is Venezuela. I mean, if you look at the Venezuelan stock market, I haven't looked at the chart for a year, a couple of years, whatever, but when they first got into their hyperinflation mode, the market just took off. And so you say, well, is that a good thing if you're in the market? Well, not really, because it's denominated in bolivars. So even if you sell your stock at a 50,000% gain, you can still buy less bread, milk, and clothing than you could prior to making that investment. So you can't just look at the number, the nominal number on the stock market. Another example of that I'd use is for whatever reason, people look at the market as though it didn't exist prior to 1981. Which is bizarre to me. Like, if you look at financial planners and what they tell people, and a lot of the kind of quote unquote gurus that you see on TV or CNBC, they always talk about you won't want to buy the dip because the market goes up over time, always, always, always. And if you look at the history of the stock market, it's gone up 12% on average. And of course, they're using a percentage number or an average gain number instead of the number that they should use, which is the compound annual growth rate. That's a big difference. And so we'll put that to the side, though. So they've got this view that only goes back to 1981. And oddly enough, of course, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, since 1981, we've been in a downtrend in interest rates, going from, call it 18%, all the way down to zero. And that, you know, and those trends usually last 20 to 30 years, and we're now probably 40 years into that. So at some point in time, that's got to go the other way. So you look at before 1981, and you realize that actually the stock market existed. And you look at, let's say, the market between 1923 and 1981, where rates actually went up and they went down, then they went back up again. And then if you adjust for inflation, you don't have, I think, I don't have my the calculator in front of me, but it was if my memory serves
me right.
It's okay,
just make it up. We just make shit up on this podcast anyways. We don't have our shit together like your podcast.
Okay. It was like a 1% annual gain, and that's compound annual growth rate. And if I'm sure most of your listeners know the difference between average rate of return and CAGR, but if they don't, make sure you look that up, because I think that's the way the CNBC folks and the financial industry really kind of pull the wool over the eyes of the average investor. Well, that's one of many ways.
You know, a great thing there for you to unpack, because you do it so well for my listeners, would be why, first off, maybe explain the difference between nominal and real, right? But also this idea of why the market going up may not always lead to prosperity, because there's, you know, obviously all these other pricing indexes that we need to pay attention to, like the cost of living, you know, the average wages, things of that nature. So why necessarily the market, if it continues to go up and go up forever, why that may not necessarily be a virtue? Can you explain that? Because Mark Spiegel always comes on and says, oh, well, if we have hyperinflation, you're going to want to be long stocks because that asset prices are going to rise, right?
Yeah, again, they rise in nominal terms, and they may rise in real terms, but they may not. And so what that means is, let's call the S&P, I'm not sure what it is, let's, what is it, 3,100 right now, 3,000, something like that?
3,380.
Oh my! Oh, there
well,
you go.
That's the futures. I don't know if that's the S&P, but that's the S&P futures.
Okay, I must have looked at it before the coronavirus came out, so of course it jumped.
You must have looked at it 12 minutes ago.
Yeah, exactly. But let's just say that it's at 3,000, and let's say that it goes up to 10,000, 20,000. That doesn't necessarily mean that if you were to sell your portfolio, liquidate, because you've got to retire, as an example, that you could buy any more goods and services. Because if the rate of inflation, and that means the and not just the asset inflation, but the prices of everyday goods and services, the McDonald's Happy Meal that you buy your kid, the haircut you get at Great Clips, you know, your shopping list at Walmart or Target, if that goes up, meaning the combined price of that, if that goes up in, a lot higher than the market does, well, then you've lost purchasing power, and it might as well have gone down. So that's the real reason why people need to look at nominal versus real or inflation adjusted, not only in the stock market, but you've got to look at that in the housing market. Whenever you're trying to analyze any type of investment, you've got to look at the you have to also look at the rate of inflation, because it's all about growing your purchasing power. I mean, who cares if the nominal number on your portfolio grows if it doesn't increase your purchasing power? That's what it's all about. So I think it's better for people to look at their investments not in terms of numbers, but in terms of how much stuff it will actually buy you. So that's step number one. Number two, and we didn't really hit on this, but I think it's important to mention, the same financial advisors that are telling people to buy every single dip and you can never lose money in the stock market because over the long run it goes up and all the things that we talked about earlier, they always seem to leave out Japan, and they always seem to leave out Europe and all of these other markets that hit all-time highs decades ago and haven't got back even close, in the case of Japan, haven't even got close to where it was, even adjusted for inflation, going back, or even in nominal terms, going back to, call it 1990. So just because it's a stock market doesn't mean that it always goes up. And you can imagine the financial advisors in Japan in 1988 and 1989, the Dave Ramseys, right? You can imagine the Japanese Dave Ramsey in 1980. Well, what was he telling everyone to do? You know, the stock market's at all-time highs, and he's just telling, oh, you got to buy, you got to buy, you got to buy, you got to buy. Japanese CNBC, if that's a thing, I'm sure back then they were saying, oh, you got to buy, you got to buy, because the market always goes up over time. And if the market does go down, because even if we are in a bubble, well, as long as you buy all the way down, then you're going to be fine, because you're just going to ride it back up over the next 10 years or 20 years. And we know that's not true. So if it can happen in Japan, it can definitely happen in the United States. Also, I think it's interesting that these same people, these kind of cheerleaders for the stock market and the economy and the Fed, will sit, you know, you'll make the argument that, hey, this money printing can't go on forever, or this quantitative easing can't go on forever. And they'll always say, oh, time out, we'll look at Japan. They'll always bring up Japan. And first of all, the quantitative easing was a lot different there, so you really can't call it the same thing. I've got a lot of videos, but Professor Richard Werner goes into that extensively, the difference between QE in Japan, US, and the UK. But I don't want to get off on a tangent there, but it's those people, those same people that say, oh, look at Japan. And then when it comes to the stock market, they completely ignore Japan. And I just think it's kind of odd that they're cherry picking like that just to benefit their narrative. But going back to the CPI, I think that's something that you mentioned right there. That's really crucial that people understand that, because we hear in the media that, let's just take GDP as an example. You know, you hear real GDP. Well, that's where they take and they adjust for inflation. And most people would just assume that they're taking the CPI. Well, they don't use the CPI. They use something called the GDP deflator, which if you look at a chart, you'll notice that there's a dramatic difference between the GDP deflator and the CPI. And of course, if you had to guess which one is lower, You know, shocker, it's the GDP deflator. So that means if whatever you're using as a benchmark is lower, then that means the real GDP, the real, you know, the headline real GDP will be higher. And that doesn't, and that just assumes that the CPI is correct. So if you go down that rabbit hole, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners look at Shadow Stats or are familiar with that website, and they point out something very clear, that if you measure inflation the same way today as it was measured, let's say in the 1970s, then the rate of inflation would be near 10%. Okay, well, if the rate of the real rate of inflation is near 10%, and we're only subtracting, call it 2% from nominal GDP, if you subtract the real number, then we've had negative GDP for the last 10 years since the financial crisis, which would make a lot more sense from a standpoint of how actual people are living. It just, the only anomaly there is the unemployment rate. But then there again, you have to unpack that number. If they measured unemployment the same way that they used to, that would also be a lot higher. So it's all these things that they're doing to just jerry-rig the numbers to make the GDP or whatever headline number they want, just to make it look good. And it's just such nonsense. And now the Fed, now I'm going to go off another tangent here. I'm sorry, Chris, but now the Fed, they're coming out with Brainard. I forgot the gal, Lael Brainard. Now she's coming out and saying that she thinks it would be a good idea to go ahead and peg the yield curve, just like they did in World War II. Okay, well, look at this. And then I think Powell just the other day came out and said that now it's not about getting inflation. Then it moves to, okay, we need 2% inflation. Well, now 2% inflation isn't good enough. Now we need inflation averaging. So if we had, call it 1% inflation for the last 10 years, well, for the next couple of years, we need 10% inflation just to kind of even things out. And if you can explain that one to me, I'd love for you to try to do a whiteboard video. I'd like that whiteboard video. If someone can do a whiteboard video on how you can come to the conclusion that because we didn't have inflation in the past, that we need inflation to make up for it on a moving forward basis, I would love to see that one.
Yeah, I'm not doing any whiteboard videos. I'll leave that to you. I would wind up putting my fucking fist through one of them. And that would be it. It would be a 10-second series. Chris Irons explains using a whiteboard. You know, I would draw some shit. I'd get angry, and that would be it. But, you know, I, just going back to what you were saying about people that are in the business picking and choosing the numbers that they want to pick and choose to support whatever their narrative is. I mean, they're reverse engineering the way that they look at finance. They want to get the stock market to where they want to get it. And they want to get these headline numbers like jobs to where they want to get it. And then they want to back their way into explanations about why everything else is fine the way that it's supposed to be. This using the PCE deflator the GDP deflator versus using the actual CPI, which, by the way, the actual CPI isn't even a good indication of inflation, right, due to all of these hedonic adjustments. But to use an even lower number than the CPI, it's just one more nonsense trick in a bag of tricks. And all you have to do is, you don't need to know what the fucking GDP deflator is. You don't need to know any of this shit. You don't need to know the difference between Japan and the U.S. quantitative easing. All you need to know is, what is the definition of a market, right? The definition of a market is where people come together and, you know, they exchange money for goods, products, services. There's buyers and there's sellers. I mean, that's pretty much the definition of a free market. And I say this all the time during my speeches, which is, if you look at a stock market like ours, and, you know, you say people forget that it's been around since before the 80s, you know, and decades prior to that, many decades prior to that. But if you go back and look at, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average from the 20s to now, you look at a 100-year chart, you're looking at a market that starts at the bottom left-hand corner of the screen and goes to the upper right-hand corner of the screen. It's a straight line up, right? So I always say, without even knowing anything about finance, if we're going to have a free market, right, what about the constant rise in the stock market, in stock prices, seems normal. I mean, that can only be achieved through gearing other variables, right? It's not a normal, you know, if you were to peg the dollar to, if we were to go back on the gold standard now, you know, and the price of oil as measured in dollars just continued to rise and rise and rise. And it went from, you know, we didn't have any inflation and it went from $10 to $200. You would say, what the hell is going on outside of the, what the hell's going on in the gold market that's being manipulated? Is it the supply? Is it the demand? Is it, you know, what's being changed to create such a drastic move upward in the price? And people need to think about the stock market the same exact way. Like, what needs to happen in order for stocks to just continue on a trajectory of all-time highs? And what's going to happen, George, is we're going to fuck with every variable that we can mess with, okay? Every single one of them, like you're saying, they're thinking about pegging the yield curve now, right? They're not going to learn until they've officially run out of tricks and until there is a psychological break and the thing just gets away from them. And then it doesn't matter whether Jerome Powell says rates are going to negative five or he says we're going to buy $5 trillion worth of stocks a day. Nothing is going to help at that point. And I think that's the inevitable end game we're going to get to. It's going to make 2008 look like a picnic. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right on the money. And one thing I'd like to point out that's probably one of the most ironic things about the Fed is that the very thing that they're trying to achieve is their kryptonite. And what I mean by that is they're trying to achieve inflation, but if they actually get inflation, meaning if that inflation genie gets out of the bottle,
right,
they're not going to be able to get it back in. And then how do you print money? So you have to look at the Fed's toolkit. And their toolkit consists of really two things, just printing money or lowering interest rates. That's what else are they going to do? That's it. They've just got a hammer, so everything looks like a nail. Well, if we get inflation to where they actually have to, let me put it this way. If we get inflation that runs so hot that they actually have to admit it, then that you take away the Fed's hammer. So now how are you going to solve all those problems that the market thinks the Fed can solve by money printing?
Right.
The answer is you can't. They paint themselves into a corner where the market just says, you know what, we're done with you. And I also want to point out something on that note. If you look at a chart of the 10-year and compare that to the Fed's balance sheet, or compare it to quantitative easing since 2008 when they've expanded their balance sheet, the crazy thing is every single time they do quantitative easing, or what they would admit to being quantitative easing, the 10-year rate goes up, not down. And it's completely counterintuitive because, you know as well as I do, the Fed's buying the long end of the yield curve. So that creates demand for those bonds. You think the price would go up or the yield would go down. But that's not what happens. And I talked to Luke Groman about this. And he thinks, and this makes a lot of sense to me, that whenever the Fed starts to expand their balance sheet, then the market sees that as, okay, we're probably going to get inflation, so we want to sell the long end of the yield curve, and we want to go into risk assets, or we want to buy equities. So that's why when you see the Fed's balance sheet expand due to quantitative easing, usually the market goes up, but the bond market, at least the long end of the curve, goes down in price, goes up in price. Goes down in price and up in yields.
Yeah. Explain to my listeners also, just kind of unpack that a little bit. Explain to my listeners what bonds, like what the default stance that people would expect bonds to do in an instance where there's quantitative easing and why. Just break down the mechanics of that a little bit for my listeners, because there's a lot of assumed and implied knowledge in kind of what you just said. Just break it down a little bit more.
Okay, first of all, let me kind of clarify what I was saying at the end there, because I obviously I didn't say it well. when the price of a bond goes down, the interest rate goes up. So there's an inverse relationship there. So if the interest rates go down, that means the price of the bond goes up. So if there was, it's just supply and demand. If you have the Fed going in and printing money to buy bonds, that means there's going to be more demand for those bonds. And so you would assume that the price of those bonds would go up and therefore the yield would go down. That's it just makes sense, especially when they're printing really trillions of dollars to do this. But what has happened, if you look at a chart and just compare it directly to quantitative easing, is every single time the Fed expands, or okay, so every time the Fed prints more money out of thin air to buy these bonds and to create more demand for those bonds, the prices have actually gone down, not up. And so going back to what Luke Groman was saying, he thinks that's because the market expects a higher inflation rate. So why the market would buy fewer bonds if they expect inflation is because if they get an inflation rate that's higher than the yield that they are being paid to own that bond, that is a transfer of wealth from the borrower, or excuse me, from the bondholder to the borrower. In other words, the person that is paying you back is paying you back with cheaper dollars.
Right.
So, and that goes back to our whole inflation thing. So let's say that you've got a bond, and let's just say the value of it is $1,000. And you buy it, and in 2 years, you get paid back that $1,000 because that's the value. You keep it to maturity. The problem is that $1,000 now buys you a loaf of bread.
Right.
So that's why there's less demand for, or what we've seen in the past since they started quantitative easing. That's why there has been less demand for those bonds from the marketplace, while there's more demand from the Fed to buy those to put them under their balance sheet for quantitative easing. So my point with that, Chris, is that if this continues, where if the Fed comes in and does quantitative easing, that actually increases interest rates, that also backs them into a corner just like inflation would, because then they can't expand their balance sheet without getting into the red zone. And what I call the red zone is if interest rates on the 10-year get above 3.5%. That's where we've seen the Fed have to back off, because the interest rates start to negatively impact the economy.
Right.
And to think clearly about this, you can just imagine what would happen to the housing market if interest rates went from where they are now up to, call it, 10%, 15%, right? So that would crush the housing market, and it would crush the entire economy, because sovereign debt, all-time high, consumer debt, all-time high, corporate debt, all-time high, state debt, all-time high. When you have all
subprime auto loans, all-time highs, consumer credit, if you didn't say it, which I think maybe you did, but sorry, all-time highs also.
Yeah, you name it. So, and a lot of that is adjustable. So, and there's no bigger subprime borrower that has an adjustable rate loan than the federal government.
Right.
I mean, they're rolling over $11 trillion per year. $11 trillion they have to roll over, or they have to buy. So part of that's rolling over because most of their debt is short term. So think about if you know, let's say their average interest rate is, call it, 1.82%. Well, what if the federal government has to start paying 5% on their debt? I mean, and you can just go on down the line. So my point, going back to what I was originally saying, is the Fed can't allow interest rates to go over 3.5%. But so how, if you're the Fed and you know that every single time you increase your balance sheet, the 10-year gets closer and closer and closer to 3.5%. And once you get to 3.5%, even if there isn't any inflation, how do you increase your balance sheet to save the economy? When what you're doing to save it will crush it.
Yeah, you're proper fucked, basically, in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. So they've got – there's a variety of ways where they can paint themselves into a corner to where they're completely impotent And there is no more money printing, because money printing will only exacerbate the problem. And that's when the market takes over. That's when the market wins. And that's when it obviously gets really ugly. But hopefully we'll have a reset and come out the other side a lot better. And the one good thing,
of course, that's not going to happen. Okay, we will not have a reset with any kind of dignity. It will be a redux of Jim Cramer crying on CNBC and shrieking into the fucking camera like he did the last time we had a crisis, and panting and moaning and whining that things weren't going his way and who could have seen this coming, and, you know, having to answer millions of viewer emails from people that are wondering why he never mentioned anything like this over the last 10 years that he's been on television. But how about this? I mean, not only are all of those points that you make extremely dead on balls accurate, but think about, without even thinking about the debt, think about what happened if rates went to 3.5% or 4%. Think of all the money that would come out of equity markets and would go into savings accounts and would go into money market accounts. And, you know, interest used to be a reward for saving your money, right? Now it's a reason to not save your money. Now it's a reason to get your money out of your bank account and into the market. So think about the huge shift in money that would occur if people were guaranteed a rate of return of 3.5%, 4%. So on top of these debt bubbles, you know, you would have this enormous transfer out of, like you said, risk assets and into things that are interest bearing. But also, you know, look, we both kind of know that higher rates would really cause a major aftershock through the system right now. I mean, they're just, the way that the central bankers talk about them, they're not an option, because that's what happens right before everything is completely fucked. What are some situations for my listeners, aside from quantitative easing and the perception of quantitative easing in the bond market, what are some situations where we would have to be forced to raise rates that could put us into this kind of, you know, force majeure type scenario where, in essence, the system just breaks? I mean, what else can get us to those higher interest rates? What can the market do to get us there and force the Fed's hand?
Well, I tell you one thing the government can do, and that's MMT. I don't want to say the problem. The reason why you haven't seen an equivalent amount of inflation when you compare that to the Fed's balance sheet or the supply of money, right? So I think everyone kind of understands that inflation is a result of two things. Number one is the supply of money. So how much money is chasing the same amount of goods and services? If you have more money chasing the same amount of goods and services, you're most likely going to get inflation if velocity stays the same. So those are the two components there. You've got the velocity of money and you have the quantity of money. So what we've had since 2008 is the quantity of money skyrocket. Everyone knows that. But the velocity of money has plummeted. And the way I think it's easiest to understand this is if you look at the U.S. as two completely separate economies. You have the real economy, and then you have the financial economy. And the only way for the money supply in the real economy to, not the only way, but the main way for the money supply in the real economy to increase is through consumer lending. The retail banks are the ones that create most of the money supply in the real economy. Right, so the Fed can print and create $4 trillion out of nowhere, and as long as it stays in the financial economy, then although the money supply has increased, the money supply in the real economy has not, and the velocity in the real economy goes down. So you have all of these cross currents going on at the same time, and that's why you've seen asset prices That's why you've seen asset prices go up so much, and let's say your burrito at Chipotle maybe hasn't tripled or quadrupled in price. And I would say probably give it time. But that it, so there's that line in the sand. And what MMT does is that gives the Fed or the government the ability to cross that line and not leave that up to the market. So now they can say, okay, we're going to expand the balance sheet or create another $4 trillion out of thin air. Because over the last 12 years, well, that really didn't cause that much inflation. And this is them talking, not me. And so why shouldn't we print up another $4 trillion? Because obviously there's no negative consequences to doing that, or else we would have seen it over the last 10, right. 12 years. And we're going to take that and we're going to do QE for the people, call it, where they go in and however they distribute that money, it goes down or it goes gets into the real economy where you see not only the money supply increase dramatically, but you would most likely see velocity increase dramatically. And that's when you get some serious inflation, not only on the asset side of the equation, but also with consumer prices. And I'm not saying that we haven't had inflation over the last few years. I agree with shadow stats. I think real inflation is up north of 5%, but you would see 1970s type of inflation. And one thing I want to point out too that I think is interesting, when people look at the CPI and the way it's measured now, we all know that if you measured the inflation rate now the way it was in the 1970s, that inflation would be similar. But we forget to look at it in reverse order, right? And what I mean by that is if you took today's CPI, the way they measure it, and take it back to the 1970s, then the 1970s would have been the most the biggest boom economy that America has ever seen.
Right.
Because in real terms, it would have gone up tremendously because the rate of inflation back in the 1970s, the official rate of inflation would have only been 2% per year. So look at how much the stock market went up. Look at how much the housing market went up. Look at how much GDP went up in nominal terms. And if you only would have subtracted 2% from that instead of the 12% or whatever they were subtracting, it would have been like the late 1800s. So you got it. It's a binary decision. You have to decide either inflation is higher today than they're saying, or inflation was a hell of a lot lower in the 1970s. I'll let you be the judge.
Yeah, and this is just something that is not conceivable to most people that are involved with setting monetary policy. I mean, they just, you know, I hate to bring up the example again, but because I brought it up on a podcast a couple weeks ago, but Neil Kashkari on Twitter out there antagonizing people that are gold bugs and hard money people. Meanwhile, gold has been rallying, right? I mean, people say, oh, it hasn't eclipsed its all-time highs. It's like, all right, fuck off. It's doing very well over the last couple of years. But to go out and kind of antagonize people as if all of the problems have been solved and now I've just got some time on my hands, you know? I can just plunk down here at the computer because Neil has figured it out and the Fed has figured everything out, right? So I've got plenty of time to just plunk down at the computer here and just talk some shit. It's like, dude, you need to be in an office somewhere with rulers and graphing calculators and a fucking protractor and Excel trying to figure out exactly what it is that you're talking about. Which is, but instead, you know, for them, it's much easier to just play whack-a-mole with their problems, right? Oh, today the problem is the job market. Okay, well, let's tweak that and we'll get the job market in order. Oh, tomorrow the problem's inflation. Okay, well, let's tweak this. And until at some point, like Ron Paul said, you know, the market is just going to make up its mind and that's going to be it. And you know what the thing is about the market, about the free market, George? There's no arrogance. You know, the free market just does what it does, and we may be able to manipulate it, and we may be able to change certain variables. There's no arrogance. It's going to do what it's going to do. It's like the planet when people talk about climate change, you know? The planet is just going to do what it's been doing. It was here for millions of years before us. It's going to be here for millions of years after us, and the market is the same kind of neutral, non-objective kind of organic entity that just is dynamic by nature, and it's elastic by nature. You know, so you can pull it as far as you can pull it in one direction, but eventually it will snap back.
Yeah, I've got a lot of things to say on that. First, I think people forget that currency does not equal purchasing power.
They definitely, not only do they forget it, but they didn't know it in the first place. And it's not people's fault, but people don't understand the difference between currency and purchasing power. So break it down. Tell us why it's so important.
Well, I think if you really get back to a very simple economy, which I do on several of my videos, but just to summarize, purchasing power is a result of your productivity. That's it. Period. If you don't, in a free market, if you don't produce something, if you don't produce corn, well, then you're going to starve to death. You have no way of consuming. So there is no consumption without production. So people conflate currency with the ability to consume, and they forget that it's your productivity that gives you the ability to consume. So my point with that is that when you have the money supply increase so dramatically from the level of productivity, and if that money supply increases the level of consumption, at some point it has to mean revert back to the level of real productivity, or else, and I know this kind of gets a little abstract, or else then it is true, then currency does produce purchasing power, and then Venezuela, Zimbabwe, they would be the richest countries on the planet Earth. So if people really are, I think the best thing they could do to start would be to start looking at consumption and purchasing power through the lens of what a society produces in terms of goods and services. That would be the first thing I would suggest. And see, I'm going back to my notes here. As far as deflation, this is one thing that, or inflation, this is one thing that really irritates me about the Fed and just the types of individuals that you're referring to. This 2% inflation target and how they've brainwashed people into thinking that this is quote unquote stable prices. This is the biggest load of nonsense I have ever heard in my life. And it really irritates me it pisses me off. I don't want to take it to that extreme.
George, just fucking curse. Just get angry. You know what? You can say, I watch all your videos on your channel. You're very measured. I come on your channel. People leave comments on the videos. They're like, Chris Irons is not a good fit for this channel. He can't make his point without freaking out and screaming and cursing. Well, let me just tell you something, George. This is the forum to do that, okay? We're not going to piss off your subscribers. My fucking listeners are used to it, okay? So you don't have to go through excruciating pain there, like I just heard you, just to say this really, this really pisses me off. Like,
yeah,
it's okay, exactly. George. If you want to scream and take a shot of whiskey, you can do it.
Yeah, all right. I appreciate your permission to just let loose, Chris. But what really pisses me off is that if you go back throughout history, and if you look at a period of deflation, so let's look at the 1800s. So if you had from the year 1800 to the year 1900, prices in the United States went down by 50%, 50%. And even when you take that to 1913, before the Fed started their shenanigans, the price level was lower than it was in the year 1800. So people say, oh, okay, so what's your point, George? Well, let's just think this through. And I did this on one of my videos. I used the example of a McDonald's worker, just assuming that they make $1,500 a month. And take home pay, and then assuming that their expenses are about $1,500 a month. Well, using the same numbers that you can see right there, especially when we're on the gold standard, the instead of the buy metal standard, the gold standard toward the latter part of the 1800s. If you use those numbers, if that McDonald's worker didn't didn't get another job in 20 years, and they were still working at McDonald's. Their level of wage would be the same, and their expenses would only be $800. You see how that works? And I want to remind everyone that's going to – and I know they're going to leave in the comments, or you're going to get emails here saying, oh, this George guy doesn't know what he's talking about, because then wages would go down and everything would implode. No. Look at the 1800s. What you'll see is GDP, even nominal GDP, went up every single year. So that would imply that McDonald's worker, their wages would actually go up. So let's say their wages go up over 20 years. At the end of that 20 years, they're making $1,800 per month. Their expenses go down to $800. They've got a net gain of $1,000 per month. Not to mention the fact that $1,000 would actually buy more goods and services. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. If you go down the list and really think through what it would mean for there to be a limit on the money supply, it would literally solve almost every single problem that we have in the developed world today.
Yeah, except it would cause a couple years of pain, or a decade of pain, that we have been conditioned to think doesn't exist, shouldn't exist, and is not a problem. And so we are going to continue to sacrifice reality for this incessant need to feel comfortable at all times. And all that's going to do is elevate the level of austerity and severe discomfort we run into without any rhyme or reason. And also, too, the person in your example that you just gave, who now has essentially twice the purchasing power and is more productive, they're also a hell of a lot happier. You know what I mean? They're at McDonald's putting salt on the French fries and fucking whistling and having a great day, because all of a sudden they've got all this additional purchasing power too. So they're being more productive, and the quality of life is essentially probably getting better as well, right?
Everyone, it's a win-win for everybody. Except the government.
Yeah, well,
that's pretty much it, because the business owner, they're making more money. The employees have far more purchasing power. It's literally a win-win for everyone. And going back to your point there about the society and how, from a psychological standpoint, it's changed quite a bit. I think you're quite a bit younger than I am, Chris. But I remember, just as an anecdotal story, and I always reflect back on this, and it just really puts things into perspective when you look at today's society, especially in the United States. And back when I was a kid, this is in the 1970s, I remember I used to love to ride my bike around. You know, we had the BMX bikes and all my buddies, and we would go up. And this was when I was like, 10 years old. In the summers, I mean, we would go out on trips for hours, miles away from parents. They didn't know where the hell we were. They just, you're driving all around, you're getting into trouble. And nowadays, of course, that would be totally illegal. My mom would have gone to prison. But also, you see all these kids riding around the park nowadays. It doesn't even matter if they're on a bicycle. They could be on roller skates. They could be on a little scooter, and they're wearing a helmet, right? And I always tell people, and this is the honest truth, with the group of buddies that I had when I was 10 years old, if you would have shown up wearing a helmet, you would have been in far more danger than how much, you know, protected you're going to be by that helmet, because every single one of my buddies would have beat the shit out of you.
Right.
that's the bottom line. And now I'm not saying that that's good, but I'm saying look at how dramatically different that is than where we are today. And then you take it a step further, and I think it's very much like the immune system, where if you sit there and put a kid in a bubble, and no pun intended, and you don't allow them to eat dirt and sand and all these things that build up their immune system, and then at the time they're 20 years old, you just let them out of that bubble into the real world, I mean, they're going to – I'm no doctor, but I assume the way it works is they're going to have some real health problems, because their immune system hasn't really been strengthened. And I think it's the exact same thing with the entire society of the developed world, and most specifically the United States.
Yeah, and I think the United States has gotten completely out of control over the last, like, decade here with this, you know, social justice warriors, and everybody's got a problem, but nobody really knows what the problem is, and everybody is feeling this insane, intense guilt and shame for things that they haven't done. And, you know, we've been conditioned, even in the world of finance, I always say, you know, in the morning is always the funniest, because you put the anchors on in the morning, and when the futures are up, everybody's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and whistling and cracking jokes. And, you know, if the Dow futures are down 0.02%, there's this morose kind of ominous feeling in the morning, or people, well, we got to find an explanation for this. It's like, you don't need a fucking explanation. Sometimes things go down. I mean, that's it. But just, I think you make a great analogy there with the immune system, right? Everybody that's being born and raised now, comparatively to how we've been, and listen, you know, my parents took great care of me, and they were always looking out for me and always, you know, telling me wear a helmet and wear your seatbelt. And, you know, but I think you make a great point. I think that gate can swing in the other direction too.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's when you see these videos like the one I was watching a couple of days ago. My friend Nathan Anderson posted on Twitter a tweet that said, you know, I found the last Tesla short in the midst of the squeeze here that happened a couple of weeks ago. And the video was this girl who looked like she was probably somewhere between 15 and 18 showing up at a Trump rally and just screaming in the faces of the people that were there. Nothing. Just screaming. Just, you know, inaudible, loud, just, you know, it just... And you think to yourself, like, what is this person so pissed off about? I mean, let's just say they disagree with the person's political stance, and that's fine. And I know there's people that just can't stand the sight of Donald Trump, and that's fine. And I know there's people that can't stand the sight of people on the other side of the aisle. But what compels you to think that you're moving the ball forward in a situation by doing something like that? And how have you been coddled growing up to believe that that is going to make some type of impact, or that you need to be the person to go out and affect change? And you know, like, I find it so fascinating when it comes to issues of politics and, you know, social justice, as it's called, when all of these people that haven't experienced shit in their life, they've never gone through trials and tribulations. You know, some of them have been handed everything. Some of them never even had a family member die, let alone any kind of financial austerity or any type of, you know, not being able to feed themselves or you know, living in poverty or things like that, or living in another country, in a third world country. You know, and these people are out there. They drive their BMWs to go out and protest social change. I mean, it's just so hypocritical. And it comes from this condition that you're talking about, which is, you know, this snowflake culture that we're in now. You don't like what somebody says, report it on, you know, Facebook. They're going to get banned.
Right.
You know, like, it's just ridiculous. I know we talked a little bit on the podcast that you and I did about the Zero Hedge ban, and this type of stuff came up. But I think you make some very cogent points when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, you know, it goes back to people being emotionally coddled as well. And I think that ties right into our macro discussion from the standpoint of, you know, I compared the 1970s and my bicycle story to today. But look at the Fed. I mean, look at what the Fed did
in
the early 1920s. I mean, we all have, I'm sure, listened to Jim Grant. He's got a fantastic book on this. But there was a massive depression in the early 1920s, 2021, I believe. And the Fed did literally zero. In fact, actually, I think they did some. I think they raised rates. And they raised rates, and the government slashed spending. And so the opposite of what we would do today. And sure enough, we had a V-shaped recovery. Bam, 2 years, we're out. And if you look at the actual numbers, they were worse than as far as the unemployment rate. And again, Jim Grant goes through all of this. But they were on a lot of metrics, it was worse than the 1930s. Now you've got the complete polar opposite of that the Fed doesn't want anybody. And I think it goes back to this emotional coddling. No one can feel emotional pain. We cannot allow that in our society. So if that means money printing, if that means doing the wrong thing for as long as we can kick the can down the road, then that narrative prevails, because that's just what we have to do, because we just it's like the last thing that we can possibly do is cause any type of emotional pain or any financial pain in the economy. So we've got to deflate or inflate away the debt. We've got to do the MMT. We've got to forgive student loans. And I'm not saying that that's a good or bad idea, but I'm just taking it back to this whole society, and then how that maybe has played an influence on the Fed and all this quantitative easing to try to smooth out the business cycle for the last 12 years.
Well, sure. And people are asking questions now about how the Fed is going to deal with climate change. You know, so all of these major, all these major issues are influencing their decisions. But stepping outside of the realm of finance, because you make some very good points just now, it's not natural, George. I said this in my last podcast called Pandemics and Other Things That Make Stocks Go Up, right?
Yeah, it's not, I listened to part of that, yeah.
It's not natural. It doesn't occur in nature. It's not natural outside of finance for us to be feeling comfortable and feeling good all the time. It doesn't make sense. All you got to do is open your fucking front door and take a look at the squirrels that are running around in your yard, okay? Do they look cool, calm, relaxed at all times? No, they're constantly fucking, you know, is something here? Is somebody going to shoot me? Is somebody going to step on me? Is something going to swoop out of the sky and kill me? They're fucking nervous wrecks, right? And the reason for that is it's natural, okay, for us to have good experiences and bad experiences, and they shape you, right? That's just the nature of things. Just to take things to like a transcendental kind of, you know, outside of the world of finance view, right? So for us, you know, and for the Fed and for us as a society, micromanaging the economy isn't enough now. Now we want to micromanage everybody's feelings and everybody's emotions. And the result is going to be the same. When we go to micromanage the economy, the more we do, the worse things are going to be when the bubble finally pops. And it's the same deal here. Because, George, can you imagine now if society, which has arguably been the most coddled that it's ever been right now, has to experience conditions like the Great Depression, and there's nothing that the Fed is going to be able to do? What's going to happen when these, you know, 15, 18, 25-year-olds that have never in their life experienced any type of downturn, any type of problem, any type of headwind at all, are the ones that have to bear the brunt of real austerity, because the free market, we woke up one morning and the free market decided to make up its mind one day, and that's it. There's no answer. You know, you can see your therapist as many times a week as you want. You can go to whatever protest you want and scream. You can vote for Bernie Sanders as many times as you want. You can make, you know, Instagram posts as many times as you want, but nothing is going to change it after the market makes up its mind. I want to dovetail from that into this situation with the coronavirus, right? Because one of the points I made on my last podcast, and I definitely want to get your take on this. One of the points I made on my last podcast is we are attempting to fight a tangible, very real, potentially existential risk in this virus, which to this day, George, we don't know the origins of, and we don't really have enough data outside of China to understand, to have a real clear, trustworthy understanding of the fatality rate, of the R-naught value, of all of these important things to gauge this virus, right? And instead of trying to tackle this issue with real-world tangible solutions, right? A virus is a virus. It, you know, it exists in the world of biology, not in the world of central banking. The conversation immediately turns to printing more money. Oh, is China going to stimulate? Oh, is the U.S. going to stimulate? And here we have the world's second largest economy that's been shut down now for basically a month, and the stock market continues to rally to all-time highs, and the conversation continues to go to money printing and central banks. Talk to me about that divergence between a very real-world existential risk, one that comes to your house and knocks on your door and punches you in the face versus, you know, trying to solve it by changing numbers on a screen somewhere. I gave the last thing I'm going to say. Sorry, I'm going to let you talk. I gave the analogy on my last podcast of if you go into a bar, George, and you piss off the biggest guy in the bar and you call him an asshole, right? He's going to get up and he's going to punch you in the face regardless of how much money you throw at him, right? Nothing is going to change that guy's fever pitch of being insulted in front of his girlfriend while they sit there and drink their Budweiser bottles. Nothing's going to change his mind to get up and punch you in the face. You could throw $1 million at him. And that's analogous, a microcosm of where we're going to reach at some point. May not be this risk, but some existential risk. Go ahead, George Gammon.
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. And it goes back to what we said at the beginning of the podcast, where it's the markets, and I'm sure your viewers know the markets a lot better than I do. I know some of the macro stuff and I can explain it, but as far as the intricacies of what moves the S&P up and down, I don't know much about that. But it just seems as though that if you see how bad the coronavirus can be, and then you see what's literally happening and really happening in China, and the market has to know how the supply chains that disrupts and all the negative impacts on the global economy that can produce, then you see the stock market go up. The only thing that would make sense to me is that they're just assuming that there's going to be more money printing, and money printing equals the stock market going higher. And I think another thing to add to that is that when we went in, the United States went in and bailed everybody out in, call it 2008, 2009, whatever, that set a precedence in the market that not only did we have a Fed put, but we weren't going to let not only people, but we're not going to let entities go out of business. It's just too important. So if you're one of those entities, then why wouldn't you just take the most insane amounts of risk on a moving forward basis? Because you know that the government is going to bail you out. It creates all of this moral hazard. All right. So taking that to where we are today, when you look at the coronavirus and you see what the negative impacts could be, it's almost a rational decision to buy the market if you believe that the governments aren't going to let any Deutsche Banks or HSBCs or you name it, they're not going to let anybody fail. And the only thing they're going to do is print money. And if you're a market participant who is young, who has never seen a downturn or has never seen 1970s inflation, never experienced the dot-com bust, you know, you can go down the list, then you think that this is a great buying opportunity. And let's just buy the dip. And I that's the only explanation that I can possibly give you
for
what's going on.
Those people don't even realize that at some point the decision isn't the central bankers anymore.
Right.
You know, it's how you – this comes down to a philosophical kind of how you look at the world.
Yeah, but that goes back to the recency bias that we just have as human beings, where we think – that, oh yeah, Chris, you can say that, but if you look at the last 12 years, every single time the Fed has been able to bail us out and markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent, and you hear that all the time, and they just assume that because it's happened over and over again for the last 12 years, it'll continue to happen over and over. They extrapolate the past into the future, and I think that ties into it quite a bit.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on the coronavirus, George. I mean, we talked about it a little bit when we did our podcast, but I did most of the talking. What does George Gammon think? Not George Gammon, the investor. George Gammon, the person with a family and friends that he wants to make sure everybody stays happy and healthy. What are you deducing from the data we've been given and the headlines that have been hitting?
I think that it's a lot worse than the mainstream media is telling us or has been telling us. I think they've kind of turned a corner here lately. Or the World Health Organization. I think they totally dropped the ball. And we could have prevented a lot of, we could have prevented a lot of people getting extremely sick if they would have come out and just said how bad it was up front. And let me mention that and circle back, because I think there's a lot of that goes back to the Fed, believe it or not. But as far as on a personal level, you know, I spend most of my time in Medellin, Colombia, and that's where I am right now. And there's a lot of things that you see in the news where you're kind of glad from that standpoint that you're out of the mix. But if I was in the United States right now, I wouldn't lose sleep over it. I would know that, but I wouldn't have my head buried in the sand either. I wouldn't sit there and just stress out over it. But I would take precautionary measures just in case there's that 2-3% probability that it does infect the United States like it's infected China. Then it's just prudent to go out and maybe stock up on some extra food or maybe extra water. Worst case scenario, you're just going to eat it, you know, at a later point in time. I don't see any downside to that at all. I don't see any downside to just being aware of what's going on and watching videos from like Dr. Chris Martinson. I would strongly suggest your viewers check out his YouTube channel, Peak Prosperity. And he's been tracking it daily. And he's a doctor. He's got his degree from the pathology department. And a lot of people, you know, they get on, you say, oh, he's not a real doctor, or he's not really this or really that. Well, he's got his degree from the pathology department at Duke University. But even if he didn't, the bottom line is he's really digging into the facts and doing the research. It's not hysterical. It's not sensational. It's just, here are the numbers, and let's be realistic about this. That's what I'm doing personally. Obviously, I'm concerned about it. I'm trying not to stress out about it too much. But for my family members in the States, that's exactly what I'm telling them to do. Just stock up on some food. There's no downside to it. And just kind of don't bury your head in the sand. Just be aware of what's going on.
Yeah, and that's what I've been saying since day one, right? There's no downside to doing that. Like I said, jokingly on one of my podcasts. I mean, not jokingly, this is the case. What's the worst that happened? I got a little extra ammo and some extra garbanzo beans in the basement. And when this all, what is he saying, Shaun of the Dead, wait for this all to pass over. We'll just head down to the pub and wait for this all to blow over. And when it does, you know, I'll have plenty of extra hummus and ammunition for everybody at the range. But, exactly. You know, I kind of advocated for the same thing. And now it's really interesting to see the mainstream media, okay? And we know, I had a text conversation with my dad a couple of weeks ago about something. I forget what it was. Maybe when Kobe Bryant died, you know, I texted him or some type of breaking news item. And he was like, you know, I don't see it on the news. How do you know? You know, and I'm like, listen, you know, I got news sources here that go directly to my phone that are first and foremost. I need to know the news as soon as it hits any wire anywhere, not when fucking Wolf Blitzer decides to report it on CNN. And right. So we know that the news is, especially if you get your news from the, you know, any cable news network, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, if you're one of those people that turns on the news at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, you're getting really last week's news a lot of time, or, you know, news from 72 hours ago. And with something like this, the coronavirus, where everybody wants to make sure that everything has been vetted 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 10 times over, because nobody wants to even step outside of the inner circle of what we know, lest we forget the fact that everybody in the mainstream media has been relying on data coming out of China for the last month, which I think is hilarious. You know, we got verified numbers. Yeah, verified. Verified bullshit, right? But lest we forget that, here it is interesting to see some things bleeding over into the mainstream media today, George, that people were labeled fearmongers for bringing up a couple of weeks ago. I was labeled a conspiracy theorist, right? And I never came out and said, hey, you know, this is wrong. This narrative is wrong. Here's the conspiracy theory, and this is definitely what happened. I never said any of that shit. And I never said everybody in the world should be going out and preparing for a global pandemic. I never said that shit. All I said was, it doesn't hurt. Like you're saying, it may not hurt to have some extra stuff. It may be a good thing to look at the information that we're given skeptically. And here we are this morning, CNBC coming out, Eunice Yoon on CNBC saying, well, you know, there are some theories out there because Wuhan has a P4 lab about, you know, bioweapons. You know, they're just theories, but they're out there. Now, if you said that 2 weeks ago, everybody was on your ass. I blocked probably 150 people on Twitter over the last 2 weeks. For people just like, calm down, you're a fearmonger. It's like, don't fucking tell me to calm down. I'm a grown-ass man, okay? I know when it's time to raise my voice about something that concerns me. And when it's not, I make those decisions, not yours. And going back again to snowflake culture, I find people hilarious, George, that think that they can tell you, hey, don't think about this, don't think about that. You know, it's like, I'm doing okay. I made it through 40 years without your indispensable advice. I'll be fine for another 40. But now, to see this stuff bleed into the mainstream media, George, very interesting. And I think that's something that could have an effect on psychology and behavior, which could continue to cripple businesses, maybe even see some actual selling, maybe into the New York Fed's bid on the S&P futures, who the fuck knows. But even as this was unfolding, George, I remember in mid-January, when the headlines first started to come out, you know, being on Twitter and talking to several people about it and saying, well, this is interesting, you know, we should keep an eye on it. And there was nothing. I go to the same place for lunch every day, George, and they always have Fox News on silent in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I noticed the first day that something was on the screen about the coronavirus, and it was like 2 or 3 weeks after I had started tweeting about it. It took that long for it to become this entity that some people talked about on the internet and in alternative media to something that was then on a mainstream network. Now, Right. The mainstream networks are talking about, oh, it may be worse than China's letting on. The Trump administration says we don't trust the numbers coming out of China. And here, again, is this other theory that's out there now of, hey, isn't it a coincidence, George, that there's a bioweapons facility in Wuhan? Maybe it's just a coincidence, right? Maybe it's not.
Yeah, but I also want to point out, I can make this, and I've got a hard deadline here for another interview, but I want to make this point. And what most people don't realize is the Fed has to take a lot of blame for this. And the reason I say that is because when the World Health Organization comes out, especially at the beginning, and they decide, okay, what type of message do we want to announce? What do we want to actually tell the public? They have to do a cost-benefit analysis, right? They have to say, okay, well, if we tell them, let's just say it's really, really bad. They say, well, if we tell them the truth that it is really, really bad, well, that's going to maybe cost X amount of or save X amount of lives, but it's going to cost X amount of economic GDP. Okay, well, if every single asset class right now is in a bubble, a giant bubble, because of the Fed, well, there's a lot more downside risk to the economy because it's been so financialized than otherwise would be. So what I'm saying is that the World Health Organization or whomever, the mainstream media, they have to downplay this more than they otherwise would have because the Fed has pumped up all of these asset bubbles. So the higher the asset bubbles go, the more people can die without the mainstream media and the World Health Organization actually admitting what the severity of the problem is, you see, because of that cost-benefit analysis. So I don't think that the entirety of the blame goes to the Fed for the mainstream media and the World Health Organization downplaying it, but I don't think we should let them off the hook there.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And all one has to do is look at some of the statements that the head of the World Health Organization has made outside of the context of all the other kind of bullshit that he said. Oh, you know, China's doing a great job. We're so happy with China. You know, oh, we're not worried about this, this, and this. And the risk remains low in the U.S. But, you know, he came out in a tweet the other day and said this could be more severe than people think. And he's, you know, the press conference when he declared the coronavirus a global health emergency, right? That was the lead from that press conference like 3 weeks ago, whenever that was. Happened on a Thursday. The big question was, hey, is he going to declare it a public health emergency, a global health emergency or not? In fact, he did. And of course, that's the lead or should have been the lead. But it got lost in all this nonsense. And, you know, oh, China's taking unprecedented measures. Oh, and we're so happy with them. And oh, this, that, and the other. And the market rallied on that press conference because they gave us the bad news, but tucked into a nice candy-coated shell with a bunch of fluff and nonsense and bullshit. And I remember tweeting out that day, the lead from this press conference is the World Health Organization declares this a global health emergency, fucking period. Doesn't matter what Xi Jinping had for lunch that day. That's the lead.
Yeah, but they can't say that because, well, they can't just call a spade because the U.S. economy is built on three things. And I say this all the time. Asset prices, debt, and confidence.
Yeah.
And confidence is probably the most important thing.
Without question, George.
So they have to be cognizant of that at all times, whether it's, and that's why the Fed comes out and they'll never admit to a potential of a recession. I mean, if you look at the indicator, the recession indicator, I forgot whether it's the Atlanta Fed or the New York Fed has it, but it never has gotten above like 30% potential. So whenever it gets to 30% potential, you know, there's 100% chance that we go into recession.
They should just recalibrate the whole scale, right? Now it's a 0 to 30 scale.
Exactly. But it just goes back to the point where they know, I don't think they're any smarter than the average Joe or any of us, but I think they do realize that the entire economy is built on those three things and confidence being the most important. And if we lose confidence, then it's just a domino effect where if you lose confidence in the economy, you lose confidence in the dollar, you lose confidence in the government, you lose confidence in the Fed, you lose confidence in the money printing, and it's just house of cards.
Yeah, and it's not going to be their decision. I mean, this is something I constantly try to bring up when I talk. My famous example that I bring up all the time is Ben Bernanke saying in 2008, the Fed's not currently forecasting a recession and the subprime crisis is contained. Well, how the fuck did that work out for you? That's my question. But I constantly bring up that example because more important than understanding whether or not the Fed is forecasting a recession, George, is that people understand that they don't have control over a real market correction or over a real free market recession. They're not in the driver's seat. They think they're in the driver's seat. The CNBC anchors, Steve Leisman, thinks they're in the driver's seat. Neil Kashkari thinks he's so much in the driver's seat, George, that he can just fuck off and mouth off on Twitter. That's how much in the driver's seat they think they are. But
yeah, it goes back to the psychological component of it, and I think that's just cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I mean, or just being an ass, as we call it in this podcast.
Or that. All right, but I got another interview here at 4 o'clock.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you said 4:45. I thought we had more time. All right. Well, listen, Mr. Gammon, here's what I want to do. I want to get on the record right now because I am predicting that you will at some point have like 10 trillion YouTube subscribers and will surpass the popularity of everybody in the world of finance because of your ability to articulate yourself and because you're just a class act and you happen to be a genius. I want to get you on the record right now. You know, I want to lock you in and say George Gammon will come back on the QTR podcast every couple months in perpetuity until the world ends. So do I have your agreeance to that? All you got to do is just say yes here on the record in front of everybody, and then I'll let you go do your other interview.
100%. I would love to do that. And I would love to have you come back on my show periodically and just get an update from your side of things as well. It sounds great.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll get a better microphone because the quality on that last one, I was screaming into my laptop microphone and I felt really bad about that afterwards. But I'd be more than happy to. All right, George Gammon, I'm going to put the link to your YouTube channel in my podcast description. So if you enjoyed the interview today, make sure you guys check out George and subscribe to his shit online. Mr. Gammon, thank you so much, brother.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.